Welcome to Season 2 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istril and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we've got some news, including some regional information, Gen Con, and general podcast stuff. After that, we're going to talk about the 2.0 article that came up, as well as the video that gave us a ton of spoilers. And we actually have our own spoiler for 2.0 that's been sent to us from FFG. And then finally, we're going to have some closing comments.
Right, John, so this is episode 16, but not only is it episode 16, today, well, yesterday, but nobody can tell which day we're recording and stuff, we hit 400 likes on Facebook, and I actually know who liked us for our 400th like. That was Harold F. Vance III. I don't know if that's the real name or not, but thank you to whoever goes by Harold F. Vance III.
Yes, and he should get in contact with us. Send us an email. Who knows what we could send him?
I certainly don't know. we're a week into, or 2 weeks into regional, so there's a bunch of regional news. What have you got for us, John?
Probably the same ones you have, Alex. I watched a good portion of the London regional at Darksphere. It had a great Twitch feed. It had actually excellent sound. It was probably the best live stream I've seen to date. The final was a Longship Thunderer face-off.
And the music started, and it was Thunderstruck by AC/DC, just yes. As that did. I mean, they put a lot of effort into this. They even had a commentary for the final match from some of the players, and I really appreciate that. It is a lot of fun.
It was actually really well done. I mean, this, to me, was like, you know, when poker just first started getting aired on TV, this was the quality of the small tournaments that first started getting aired, so... Good on them. Like, they're doing, you know, high quality stuff.
That was won by Marco Guida, who's from Italy, but lives in London, has been part of the London meta for a while, with an HOD Thunderer in that mirror match against Lol Craven, who we saw on the Twitch stream earlier playing a game as well. So thanks to Darksphere. If anyone that was attending or that can get in touch with them and just thank them on behalf of us and the community and the people watching, they did a great job. I also got some news out of the Singapore regional, which happened about midweek, and this was their first regional ever, and it was won by Chui Kwa. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. Unfortunately, that starts to be the regions of the world where my pronunciation falls apart. But that was won by Targ HOD Aegon's Hill with Bungled Orders, which is...
That's posted, actually.
Yeah, he posted it on Aegon Cards.
Yep.
Now, there were two other regionals this weekend that I know of, one in Kuwait, and I've tried to get in touch with Zaid, and one in Chile, and I tried to get in touch with Francisco to get the stats for those. I haven't yet heard back from them, but hopefully we'll have that information in the annals. The other two are already in there.
So there's some big news for Gen Con, at least. The 11th is when we can actually see when the AGOT tournaments are. So that's tomorrow.
That's the day people are listening to the podcast.
You're right. Right, not tomorrow. Today. That's today.
So this is not the when you can buy tickets. That doesn't happen till the 17th, so it's still before our next episode airs. But on the 11th, you should be able to see the listings for all the events, so you can plan out your weekend or plan out your best 4 or 5 days in gaming, whatever they say it is, and make sure that you know when the Thrones 2.0 tournament is and so on. And then on the 17th, at noon Eastern, you should be able to buy your registration tickets.
Yeah, and we'll probably be doing some outside throne events, and I'll post a little thing on AGOT Cards to highlight the days that I will be doing such things if other throners want to join.
Yeah, once we know the schedule for the official events, basically.
Exactly, yeah, because we'll be at the thrones on the official events.
Now, before we jump into the last little thing, I do want to mention there are some minor audio glitches in this episode. Partly, I had to get rid of some of the background sound because of some mic interference and some issues like that. Overall, I think it worked out fairly well. It sounds a little bit like Darknotch is maybe recording from inside a garbage can, a little bit of reverb or something. But other than that, hopefully it's okay. It shouldn't be too painful, but I am sorry. I think that was on my end. And then aside from that, FFG has really, really stepped up marketing for everything in the last 2 weeks. Almost every day has had an article about one game or another.
Yeah, the one thing about those articles are they're only really hitting the audience that goes to their site. I'm hoping to see some marketing that hits new players or outside of the current gaming sphere.
Well, it depends. I mean, for something like the announcement of the first war pack in Conquest of the next cycle, it makes sense that that's not necessarily Absolutely. Trying to recruit broader. But yeah, for the 2.0 one, I'd like to see stuff cross-posted on BoardGameGeek and things like that as well. But I mean, every day last week, we had at least one official article from FFG, the most important of which, of course, was the only game that matters, which I guess we should talk about.
Yeah, I guess so.
We're talking about the spoiler article for Second Edition that was released on Monday the 4th. But by the time this airs, there will have been another spoiler article on Monday the 11th about plots. We haven't seen that. We just know it's coming because of that article. So we may say a whole bunch of things that turn out to be completely wrong by the time you listen to us. But that should be fun.
It's mostly Alex's fault, anything that's wrong. Even if I say it, all the right things Alex or Florian or I might say, that can be attributed to me.
So that's a way of saying that we have a guest today. We have Florian for part two of our Game of Thrones spoilers.
Pleasure to be here.
Whom is an excellent person?
Don't, John, don't. Ow. Ow. Ow.
I'm going to say whom as many times as today, Alex.
Even when it's completely inappropriate.
Oh, yes. It's happening.
I will enjoy this punishment. I'd love to see Alex suffer.
Well, you'll just have to hear me suffer instead. So, Florian, you joined us for the spoiler where we read way too much into the back of the box. But we actually have some real meat to discuss today. And I wanted to start with the article from Nate French. Have you had a chance to read that?
Yeah, I've just read it. I only saw the cards like 4 or 5 days ago. And I read the article as you told me that we're going to be on in 1 hour.
Okay, excellent. So any thoughts about the article, first of all?
Well, I think he's trying to keep it clean. It's very cautious, like circumscribing what is coming for us. It's not as meaty as I was expecting it to be. But I think it's fine. We got a plot spoiler with Heads on Spikes. I think that's cool. And overall, it introduces the whole thing nicely, I think.
Yeah, I think it's a great entry point because, you know, he talks about the process of the creation and how much effort and time he's put into this compared to some of the other great games he made, which, you know, makes me really excited because if those other games were great and he put this much effort, this much playtesting into Thrones 2.0, you can only think that that product's going to be just fantastic.
I mean, I think Florian's right. It was fairly tame in that it seems to be that the first part is going over what we already knew from the announcement around worlds, you know, pointing back to that letter, and then some of the other stuff is just a vague description of playtesting and.
Well, it's perfect setting the scene.
But yeah, exactly. He does mention, you know, next week we're getting a plot article, and you know, this is probably the start of the whole process. So there couldn't be that much meat in this article. It just had to set the stage. But there were a couple of big things. So first of all, he mentions that he split the playtesting group into four groups, one specific for melee, one specific for joust, one for the out-of-the-box experience, so on. And my favorite comment that I heard about this is that if you notice the plot art for Heads on Pikes, that head in the front is Nate French. The general opinion is that's what he must have felt like after managing that many playtest groups.
Now, the question is, will the plot article give us any hints who the other heads on spikes are?
That's right. The most annoying playtesters just seen from the back.
There was an interesting tidbit at the end, Alex. It talked about the editors. There was three editors, it seems, and they were named in the article. Did you notice that?
I noticed that there were three names. I noticed that those names were Kevin, Alex, and Patrick.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I can't say anything more.
I think it's
free to guess which Alex, which Kevin, and which Patrick that might have been. It could be anyone.
It's probably Kevin, as in K-Tom. It's Alex Hines and Patrick. I don't know his full name. Is it Patrick Brennan or something? Conquest. And I think he has connections to the playtest groups as well. So I think it's that trifecta.
You might very well think that. I couldn't possibly comment.
No, but that to me speaks volumes as well, because we know that they had a bunch of editors on this, and I think that 1.0 sometimes suffered from probably just the lack of manpower on FFG's side for editing. So hopefully with three keen eyes, the community knows our active rule people, hopefully all that those types of things would have been removed.
And I mean, it makes sense, because people like K-Tom have been part of FFG by extension for a long time now, so why shouldn't they contribute in such a way? And I think that's a very sensible thing to be doing.
Well, it's great that, you know, with the playtesting and the editors, there's so much community involvement in the creation of 2.0, because I think that'll make it a better game.
The other main thing, I'm sure it'll be talked about more in the plot article that we won't have seen yet, but they mention some changes to the plot rules and the reasoning behind it, which is this idea that you can have two copies of a single plot in your plot deck, which is sort of like opening up Power of Blood, but to everything, kind of. I mean, what do you guys make of that?
Two Valors is going to be scary.
I don't think that there's going to be two Valors. I mean, Valor had limit once per plot deck for a reason.
Even in the LCG, when it wasn't for a reason.
Oh, so you guys think you're going to do that? They're going to have limit one per plot deck on certain plots? Makes me cry inside.
I think we've already seen an example on that in the spoilers.
Oh, did we? I haven't actually...
Yeah, it's Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones has a plot deck limit. Well, yeah. There we go. I think you're right. Valor would probably have a plot deck limit. But for me, this is a really... Even now in the meta, rare is the time where I run two Power of Bloods, right? Power of Blood, I count on myself to be able to time it properly. I really don't want to run a second one because I need seven different options. So I don't think it will greatly decrease diversity, but it will allow you to sort of double down on certain effects. Right? And I think more importantly, it means there's more viable plot decks right from the beginning. Because
yes,
almost any plot deck can be doubled, or any plot can be doubled. That increases the amount of plot decks, possible plot decks, not necessarily viable plot decks, by an order of magnitude.
Yeah. It also means that, like, you know, those, they're going to have a limited number of plots, obviously, in the box set. So even if there's only one or two claimers, that would allow people to make very aggressive decks, and other people, if there's one or two control plots, then maybe they can make very controlly decks. And I think it really does open up a ton of options, like you were saying, Alex.
Now, what about strategically? Like, how when playing, do you think that's really going to affect when you delay your second plot, because that informs your opponent as to what your only duplicated plot was? You know, if you play that Wildfire and then you play the second one, then he knows that none of your other plots are duplicated? I don't know if that is it just a deck building thing, or will it matter in play?
I don't think it will matter in the sense that when you reveal your second plot, your opponent knows that none of your other plots can be duplicated, because you're gonna choose your most powerful plot as your second copy,
yep.
Which means that that the most impulse thing has already happened when you reveal your second plot or something, and then it won't really influence your opponent's decision that much anymore.
For instance, if we imagine that you could have two Valors, then your play would change completely once you saw the second Valor. But, yeah, I think you're right. That's more because of the second Valor, not because of the other plots that could have been duplicated.
Or, like, if you could have two Valors, you saw a second plot of something else revealed, then your play would change. You'd be like, okay, there's no other second Valor. I can barf it.
Yeah. But as we mentioned, we have this plot, Heads on Spikes. We finally get to see where reserve value was, because we were looking at the cards on the back of the box and we couldn't figure out where a fourth value would be. Turns out it's hiding in the bottom right corner there. And that value is 6. Does that surprise you guys? Did you think reserves are going to be higher or lower?
I mean
it's just
tough.
A plot. But
exactly. It's tough to judge with a small sample size. I bet once we get the plot article, we're going to have a lot more. You know, I always thought that reserves were going to actually have a really wide margin depending on the strength of the plot. I thought it was one of the things, you know, with Gold Initiative and Claim, they were going to use to control the strength of a plot. So Heads on Spike seems like a powerful effect if you compare it to 1.0, but really it's tough to judge what 4-6-1 is for a stat line of plots in 2.0. I know I've seen a lot of people complaining on the boards about it, and maybe a reserve of 6 is under average or average, I don't know. I mean, we don't know how much we draw in this game yet either. All those factors will make a big difference on what reserve means.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
People seem to be convinced that this is the plot you're going to run twice in a plot deck. And admittedly, my first glance was sort of, this looks kind of like a Winter Festival, except, you know, slightly more versatile, but a little hit or miss. And that's probably unfair. I think it's much better than that, because you're always getting the discard, so you're always getting that card advantage. But, you know, I'm still not convinced it's, as one player put it, military intrigue and power claim in a plot form. I think that's a gross exaggeration.
How would it be military claim?
Well, because the card you're discarding goes into the dead pile. That's, I think.
Oh, well, if it's still, the opponent didn't have to invest in it. It's not the same thing.
Yeah.
But for me, the idea is on the first turn, if you're revealing this on the first turn and you're discarding a card from their hand, you're discarding one out of nine cards, or one out of seven, soon to be nine, and that's not as impactful. And later on, it's less likely to be a character, right? If you flip this on plot four, chances are he's holding events in hand, or I don't know.
The effect of discarding one card is relative to how much we're going to draw. Maybe we draw three cards a turn in the draw phase, or only one, and then this would be more powerful. We don't know that yet.
That's true.
I would like to quote something here from Eggertcards. A comment from Sulpurus, I don't know. I think he, I think it could be deduced that he's somehow related to the Chinese playtesters, and he said, I have no idea whether FFG had adjusted these cards or not. Nor do I know whether this is the final version, but it is clear that they did nerf Heads on Spikes. This card was found far too powerful with a 2x set in game testing. Now, obviously, everyone can purport to be a playtester, but I think there's something to be found here. Killing a character from their hand is very powerful, especially when there are not very many unique characters in the game. And with only a very limited card pool, there are only going to be a few key unique characters, and people will have to run more 2x or 3x copies of powerful unique characters in their deck.
I think that's actually a very valid point, and I think...
So this might
further
be powerful.
Push you to use banners, which is the next thing that gets spoiled in this article, because you have to increase your unique base beyond whatever small card pool you're going to get.
Right, and this might be the type of card that's really powerful out of the box, but diminishes in strength as the card pool gets bigger. And I'm okay with that. I don't mind having a really cool plot that, you know, sees a lot of play, and then actually because of just natural card pool expansion without restriction kind of becomes less valuable as we play. So since we're talking about the plot, so it's 4 gold, 6 initiative, 1 claim, and there's 2 traits, it looks like, Edict and War. This makes me think that traits might be more important, I hope more important in 2.0, because I'm hoping they're not just sticking random traits on plots.
Yeah, Edict seems like an odd trait to just put there. War also. If you were just trying to be descriptive, you would probably make this like Spikes or something. I don't know.
It seems like there's more something about that, right?
I hope the other thing to be noted here, I think, is that when revealed, seems to be a triggered effect. Now, does that mean that cancels can now cancel plot effects?
It's bolded. It looks like a triggered effect to me.
Yeah.
I don't necessarily think that's wrong. It depends on what the cards say. I mean, if it says cancel a triggered ability on plot cards, or if it says cancel triggered ability on non-plot cards, again, we don't know what the cards will look like down the road. But I don't really see it. If they're getting rid of passives, which they really should, it makes sense to have this bolded.
Yeah, as long as they don't print Harrenhal to cancel all the triggered effects on plots.
The real question, though, is it still compulsory?
Huh, that's an interesting question.
Because, I mean, if it's something like Wildfire and you can choose not to trigger the when revealed, that's a pretty big deal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even more so with Valor. Like, Valor would be less likely to backfire if you didn't have to trigger. You'd still be forced to play a 2-0-0. That would suck. But, I mean, maybe because it's bolded, you get to choose whether or not to trigger it, and that would change a lot.
It'd be cool. I think it's good, too, because then we never have to back up and be like, oh, we forgot to do this or that.
I don't know. I'm hesitant. I mean, I think you lose design space unless there's a way to force. I guess if it's got a constant effect, then it's not a triggered effect. So maybe it makes sense to have the triggered one still optional. I don't know.
Yeah. There's also no precedence case for this, because when revealed is completely new to the entire terminology of FFG LCGs in the sense of a bolded effect.
As a bolded effect, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it makes sense. It was a separate timing trigger in 1.0, right? When reveals happened before other passives, and that was completely arbitrary only because we said so. And so by having different types of abilities, it makes a little more sense.
Yeah.
All right, are we ready for some spoilers?
Well, we're ready for the next thing in that same article, which is the banners. I think the banners are a huge thing to talk about.
That's true.
So I guess maybe start us off, Florian?
Yeah, sure. Maybe I'm just going to read it out first. For example, you can have a banner for each house, and you can play that banner as an agenda, and then you can put at least 12 non-loyal cards from that house into your deck. So what that does is, it's basically an alliance that you get for free, but you have to put at least 12 cards of the house you're in allegiance with into your deck.
So the way I understand this is you're never going to be able to put loyal cards outside of having the right faction, just like in Conquest.
Yeah.
Right? Loyal cards, if you have a loyal character for House Bearer, you're never going to see him unless you have a House Bearer house card. But the rest can be included, but only if you have a banner for that house.
Yes. I think it's a cool idea to give everyone the opportunity to play out of house cards in your faction, because it makes for a lot more interesting deck building. Maybe it's a bit far-fetched here, but I really like Call of Cthulhu, because it allows you to explore all the different faction combinations. And this just supports this, especially the line that you have to have at least 12 cards of that different faction in your deck means that there's gonna be a lot of variety here. You're not gonna play this agenda just to splash one bomb card from the other faction. You're gonna have to work out a different deck, and I really like that. And I think that's also the idea behind the 12 card minimum, because
you can't cherry pick two cards.
Yeah, I suspect that was one of the problems of playtesting, that people would just run, I don't know, three times the Viper. I don't know what is good, obviously, but just pick three times a very good card in that faction and run it like that.
Yeah, overall, I think this will open up a lot of deck building, and I think it will do it straight out of the box, which is the most important thing. The card pool is going to be very small, but in theory, you could take your house and banner it to any other house in any possible combination, and that a House Bearer banner of the Kraken or whatever, it will be different from a House Greyjoy banner of the Stag. And I think that increases variety from the start, which will hopefully stop things from being too stagnant until the card pool builds up.
I also hope that there's going to be a balance between playing no agenda and playing with an agenda right from the get-go. Because that was one of the initial problems in the first edition, that for a very long time, it was just better to always play with an agenda. And at some point, that shifted, and then it was very good to not play with an agenda for a while. And now we're kind of getting into a territory where it's very balanced. And I would like to see that right from the beginning in the second edition.
Well, I guess the question is it a drawback to have to include 12 cards, 12 non-loyal cards in your deck from another faction? Like, are 50% of the cards or all the good cards loyal? So in doing this cherry picking, you're also making your deck a little bit weaker. And that's almost impossible to tell right now, whether there's a drawback to the Banner of the Stag or whether it's just purely an advantage.
But as the card pool gets bigger, you would think that there'll be more and more non-loyal cards that are good from each faction.
Presumably, yes. Yeah. I did have one thing that has come up. A couple of people have talked about not necessarily wanting, say, Night's Watch to be able to ally with another faction and vice versa. And honestly, I think if you think of Game of Thrones as all not just the story that happened in the books, but the history and the alliances and allegiances that have been made and broken in plays for the throne in the past and that will be made in the future, I don't think you can restrict it to that. I mean, the Night's Watch is currently practically being supported by Baratheon, and you know, and in the past they've had a lot of support from the Starks. We've had, you know, pairings where the Lannisters were on the same side as the Starks in the war against Aerys, maybe, depending on who you ask. So I think it makes more sense to open it up than it does to have, you know, two or three restrictions about factions that would supposedly never work together.
Yeah.
I guess if that's that, there's just really one more tidbit in this article that I wanted to touch on. This, it's the line, "We also revisited the melee titles and made some improvements to the melee game. The multiplayer titles have new effects, and there's a lot more secrecy during the selection process."
Excellent.
I don't know. What does secrecy during the selection process mean?
I have no idea, and I'm not the right person to ask here, probably, because I'm not much of a melee player.
Maybe you have more titles and you pick them in hiding. Like, maybe there's 12 titles or something, and, you know, you take one and you pass one to the left, kind of like in Hearts.
Oh, or maybe, there are 12 and you ditch one and take one. And so 10 are given to the next player. And he doesn't know which one you have.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So he doesn't know which one you have.
Or maybe you all pick, maybe there's six and you pick them each, like, face down. Like, you know.
Oh, I don't know if I like it to be random. I'd like it to be a decision, yeah. Right?
Hello?
Even if the decision has some random element to it, I'd prefer it had a decision. Maybe you're given the pool of six and you get to look at three and pick one, and then you have to put them back in the pool or something like that. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. If there's 10 and you take only 6 of the 10, and then the first person, you know, takes one and passes it, and then no one will, like, you can't
know which ones weren't there until they're, or maybe you don't even reveal your title until the challenges phase, which would be crazy.
It would be funny if your titles were fixed now, like you were always the master of coin, you didn't redraw.
Well, that wouldn't be secrecy in the selection process.
The first selection it would be, right?
Okay, I suppose. Anyway,
Melee.
To close off the article, I think the sort of closing comment tells me that this was the first core that was built with rotation in mind. He uses, you know, the idea that this was built with foundational cards, knowing that these aren't going to rotate out. And I think that's important. Game of Thrones really is the first card game that will be built with this whole new system in mind. Chapter packs are going to rotate out, and you know this when you're designing them, because that hasn't been the case for even, you know, Conquest most recently.
Yeah, I hope that we won't have a POTS wiper in the core set, and then we're good to go.
All right. It also included a video which had a ton of spoiled cards, some fairly nice music, a bunch of completely illegal plays in it, as many people have pointed out. Thankfully, a viewer of the video has taken a whole bunch of screenshots, and so rather than watch the video step by step, we'll work through the screenshots to be able to discuss cards. So, Florian, want to start us off with the first card in that list of pictures?
Spoiler time. We're starting off with a Stark event, For the North. It's a zero-cost event, and you can only play it during what I think means a military challenges. And
it's like a sword,
it says, action, choose a participating Stark character. Until the end of the challenge, that character gets +2 strength. If you win the challenge, draw one card. So that's basically Endless Endurance, but without the recurring, and you get to draw a card instead. Which I like, I have to say.
Endless Endurance people tended to forget about and was fairly
complicated. Zero cost, it replaces itself. It's good.
Oh, that is important to note, by the way. An event that has a gold cost in the upper left corner.
Yeah. And I'd like to say, because I know you mentioned, and we'll get to it in characters, but one of the things that kind of bothered you for the back of the box was the borders. And here we can see that the borders have a lot more texturing to them. So they actually bother me a lot less in this high resolution.
Yeah.
Yeah, they look good. Cards look good.
They do. This is a card with an exclamation mark. Those bother me. Retaliation exclamation mark. No, that's just the objection to have. I think it replaces itself and it costs nothing. So even if you don't need the strength boost, it's not a bad card. So, I mean, we don't have anything to compare it against, but in a vacuum, it seems sound.
So wait, now that I mentioned it, it also has the same artwork as Endless Endurance, which is interesting.
It has the same artwork as Endless Endurance, and there's another card that has that same artwork as well in 1.0.
Rob Stark,
that's right. But it's really nice artwork, and it's framed from a different perspective, so I can't complain about that.
Stand a little bit on the fence about this recurring artwork stuff, though. On some plots, I just think it feels weird to have a card in your hand that does something different than the card you're associating with that picture.
Sometimes it's ones like later on we'll be talking about the Game of Thrones plot. That's Bound by Duty. When's the last time you played Bound by Duty?
Yeah, never.
Okay, so I think we're safe there.
I'm safe there, but I really dislike it on whatever Fear of Winter has become.
John, want to give us another card from this?
Yeah, we got one cost event. Winter is coming. It's just behind for the north in the picture. It says play only during, I'm guessing, challenge action. Until the end, I'm going to guess challenge again. Raise the claim value card by one. I'm going to guess plot. Max one per, I'm going to guess.
Challenge.
Challenge.
It might be until the end of the phase that you raise your claim value. I mean, that's hard to tell, too.
I'm basically thinking of it as the current winter is coming.
Well, if it is, it costs one more. I mean, it has a gold cost.
It has a gold cost, yeah.
Yeah.
That would be the only difference, though, basically. The text would be the same, right?
Pretty close. Functionally, it seems like it could work in that same way. And the artwork is actually also reused. That's
the plot from Stark, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the Stark unique plot.
I think there's evidence to support that it is for one challenge. Because if it was for the entire phase, you wouldn't need the play restriction, play only during a challenge.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I think that makes sense, yeah. I guess I can walk us through another card. So it looks like there's a version of Ice with Ned Stark cleaning ice under the Hearthwood tree. It's a Valyrian steel weapon, just like we'd seen on Longclaw before. It says something ter only, so I'm guessing Stark character only or unique character only, something like that. It looks like that character gets +2 strength, and then some text after you win a military challenge in which attached character is participating. Ice, kneel ice to choose and kill a character controlled by the losing opponent, maybe?
Yeah.
I think it is discard ice, because in which attached character has has roughly the same amount of characters as discard. I think kneel is too short.
You're right, it probably is. Discard ice. Okay. Well, that's 3 gold for targeted kill.
Which has an effect.
I guess it has the +2 strength to boot, and so it's sort of a threat on the board. But I'd like to point out, because a couple people have already, that the Stark icon on this has a little white banner thing under it. And some people have been saying, and I don't know which way it works, but that might be the loyalty indicator. So For the North doesn't have it, and Ice does.
The actual House Baratheon and the little banner says, like, Ours is a Fury or whatever. It looks very similar to that. Like that same
scroll. Yeah, like scroll where Winter is coming on the House Stark one as well. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that makes me think that it's probably a loyalty indicator. Because, I mean, I would think Ice would be more loyal than For the North.
I don't know. I mean, that's kind of arbitrary.
Okay, I think we'll get more information when we see more spoilers.
I heard people complaining about the new heraldry, like the House Stark card with the huge tongue. But that's actually fairly historically accurate. A lot of the old heraldry had ridiculously long tongues. So when I saw the Stark one and the Lanny one, I actually thought those looked pretty good.
Yeah, I think it looks great. In high res, this stuff looks great.
The only one I don't like, and we'll get to that later, the Greyjoy one, maybe I'm just too much of a Greyjoy fan to accept any change. I'm like, I don't really like the house card, but whatever.
Also, Krakens do not have tongues. So what the hell is up with that?
All right, so shall we scroll down to the next set of images? And Florian, give us whichever one's your favorite out of this, aside from the fact that, of course, Ice, Longclaw, which we already know is Night's Watch character only, is for some reason attached to Eddard Stark.
I can probably start us off with the least favorite.
Okay.
It's Gates of Winterfell, because we can read its name, although we can only see, like, one-third of the card.
That's right.
It's not the top.
Deck. Return.
Okay. But that aside, I'm just going to go with Arya Stark.
Which has
Arya Stark is a 3-cost character. It is, by our standards, not loyal. Has a power icon, 2 strength, is a lady, and she has stealth, which I assume is the same as in the first edition. And she has, while Arya Stark has a duplicate, she gains a military icon and a reaction that says, after Arya Stark enters play, place the top card of your deck on her face down as a duplicate. So she's basically Sir Davis Seaworth from the first edition, who gets a duplicate when he comes into play. And then she has another set of cool abilities. I like her.
But by this wording, I'd have to put the card on top of her.
I don't think so.
On her face down. Bam! That covers
depends
up. How are we going to read the text,
Alex?
Attachments
might be on as well.
So the dupe has to cover her face? What?
That's
right.
What
she has
seems.
To become a faceless man eventually, right? This seems fairly Nedly that she can be trained to have a military icon, that she's fairly resilient. I don't know.
I think it's good.
I think, again, it's hard to judge power level, but in a vacuum, the card looks good.
I think it's good, but I think there's going to be more downsides to free and lower cost characters in the second edition because of an event or attachment that is spoiled later for the Night's Watch. I'm not going to go into that right now, but I think 4 is going to be the turning point where the real strong characters are going to emerge that cannot be targeted by those kinds of effects. So I'm skeptical. Not sure yet.
John, want to give us another card?
Sure. 3 cost. What we think is, well, the military icon for sure. It looks like it's loyal. Summer, who's a direwolf. No attachments. When you control Bran Stark, he gains insight.
First instance, and we'll see it later again. That's clearly a keyword.
Yeah.
And that might be the keyword that we were seeing on Robert Baratheon, because it looked like it started with an I. It might not be. But maybe Robert Baratheon had insight as well. That's what I'm thinking.
Insight might let your opponent look at maybe the top cards of your deck and reorder them, or look at your hand or something. I don't know. It sounds like intelligence. Kind of spine. I guess that would make sense with Bran since he's a Greenwalker. Reaction. After Summer enters play, return a Stark character with printed cost 2 or lower from your discard or dead pile to your hand.
I'm guessing Bran Stark will be a character with printed strength 2 or lower.
I mean, you could use it on Arianne Stark already. So,
you can already use it on Arianne.
And that's going to be a very good effect because, as already mentioned, we're going to have to play a lot more unique characters and multiple copies of unique characters. So getting a character that is unique back from your dead pile is effectively drawing a card and making other cards in your hand active that might have been dead.
Yeah, I think that's very good.
Right. Again, in a vacuum, this card looks really good. We don't know what Insight does, but it almost doesn't matter. It's a card that replaces itself and puts a character on the board and has phenomenal artwork. Like, really, really nice.
Yeah.
So
I agree there.
I like it. I think we're starting to see the beginnings of a cost curve. We're starting to see some other things. But, you know, even if he only had that reaction, chances are I'd consider him. So,
yeah. I mean,
whatever Insight is, unless Insight's
a
drawback, but that doesn't seem very likely. All right, well, I'll give us the next card on the list, which is a 6-cost military power bicon, Strength 5, Robb Stark, who looks like he's loyal as well. He is only a lord. He's not a king yet. He has Renown, which we actually have text about on Eddard, so we know what it does. It's basically the same thing as first edition. And it has
almost,
a reaction.
Except you have to choose to do it, right?
I know, it says may. I was going to get into that. May gain 1 power, but we're jumping ahead of ourselves. He has the reaction. After a Stark character you control is sacrificed or killed, stand each character you control. Limit once per round. Now, there are 2 things about that. 1, what is sacrificed? And 2, I don't remember 2.
Stand each good?
I guess it says stand each and not stand all, which I think is a great thing because if a character is immune to character abilities, it doesn't mess the whole thing up. Anyway, irrelevant.
I think 3 should be, thank God they've learned from the past and printed limit once per round on this, just saying.
Yes, okay, yes. That's actually good. And so sacrificed, I don't know. We haven't seen any card that says sacrifice on it. Is sacrifice, like, discarded from hand? Is sacrifice...
When I think of sacrifice, I think of someone taking to an altar and getting their head chopped off to the Red Queen. So to me, it's like, king's blood's powerful.
I like how
or whatever.
That mixed so many metaphors and books, it's not even funny.
Yeah.
The Red Queen chopping people's heads off is Alice in Wonderland. Sacrifice to the Red God would maybe be what you were talking about, but that would require fire. That was an excellent sentence there, John.
I'm working on it. Hey, I didn't do a biblical quote, so you should be happy.
Wait, is he redeemed now? I mean, from whom?
Whom would have a problem with that quote? That's what I want to know.
Ay, ay, ay.
So, we can see Robb Stark, whom has this ability.
We're losing listeners, guys. We're losing listeners.
This is for Alex.
We don't know what sacrificed is. If it's a specific card effect?
I believe it's just the same thing we've been doing to Harrenhal the entire time. Just a way to distinguish killing your own characters as part of a cost. So, because there's always been this recurring issue in Game of Thrones first edition that when you kill your own character as part of a cost, can I save it? That's the first question everyone has. So if you have if you distinguish that and saying if you sacrifice a character, it cannot be saved from the right from the beginning, then this question is done. We don't have to answer this in every Roots forum ever.
And I'd like to say, so far, Nedliness, we said Arya was good. Summer has these interactions with Bran. And Rob, this is, you know, this is Eddard dying and he rallies the North, right? A start character you control is killed. Stand each character you control. I think, again, it's nice Nedly nod.
Speaking of
Eddard. Eddard, our first seven-cost character, he has a military icon and a power icon and 5 strength. He's a lord and a small council. I'm sure he's a small council member, but in this case, he's a small council.
He is a small council all by himself,
and he has renown.
A very small council.
He has renown, which is basically the same as in the first edition, but as Alex already pointed out, you may gain 1 power instead of you must gain 1 power. And he has a reaction that reads, after a challenge is initiated against you, stand at a Stark. Though there seems to be a theme emerging here that Stark is going to be the stand faction, because it does the same thing as Rob, standing your characters. And I think that's interesting.
Yeah, that used to be a very Baratheon theme, but it seems to be a Stark theme now.
I mean, it kind of makes sense, because they've put down so many times, and they always come back. I mean, you step 3 of them, and 2 more come into their own and take their spots.
You get rid of Eddard, and then Rob causes problems. You get Eddard Rob and Wyman is supporting Rickon, and yeah. I can kind of see that.
Also, Eddard was the one that rushed beside the Baratheon banners to take King's Landing, right? Like, he was alongside Rob.
Yeah, so it kind of makes sense. If you poke him, then, you know, never tickle a sleeping dragon, or whatever the case is. I like the artwork. This starts to make me think I might want to play Stark, which is weird.
Why is that weird?
I don't know.
Can you elaborate on that?
Stark. I haven't played a lot of Stark.
Maybe you should. Stark is awesome.
Stark is awesome. Says the inventor of Grand Theft Location.
What I have to state here, though, is FFG likes to tease us, and they like to tease us good. I mean, they give us cards in the spoiler article, or in the spoiler video, where renown is explained, the keyword that we already know, but they don't show us cards where insight is explained on card.
I think that's deliberate, yeah. It's like,
yeah, that's totally deliberate.
All right, well, let's move on to the next picture, which is basically a screenshot, as we have it, of all of the banners and house sigils, which, like I said, the only one I'm not terribly happy with is the banner of the Kraken, but all the other ones I think look really good. Although it is odd that the crow has a tongue as well. So
it's a worm in its mouth.
Okay.
Yeah.
But so that does crow, confirm the whole has color a worm palette. In its mouth.
So well, maybe it's a fire-breathing crow.
Fire-breathing crow. So let's move on then to the Night's Watch. John, want to give us a card?
Sure.
In fact, take you can even give black. Us your namesake?
Oh, I was going to do Take the Black because it's in order. 6 gold character. Jon Snow, he does not seem to be loyal per our decision of what loyal is. He's a bastard and a steward, which both makes sense. So I guess this is where he first joined the Watch before he became a Ranger.
Became a Ranger.
Well, didn't he go out over on the wall with the Rangers?
Yeah, but he was still a steward.
Oh, okay, my mistake. No attachments except weapon. While Jon Snow is standing, he is considered to be participating in each challenge in which you control another attacking Night's Watch character. So basically, he's throwing 4 strength into every single challenge that you're initiating or defending on, I guess, as well. Wow, he's really good.
Well, in
modern day standard, he's awesome.
Longclaw, the card that we saw right next to it and that we've seen before. If you give him +1 strength and renown, you can get 3 renown out of him in a turn.
Oh, more than that.
4, right, because he could defend a challenge as well, yeah.
What I find really interesting here is that he has a steward's trade and only an intrigue icon. And maybe that's going to be a theme for the Night's Watch in the second edition, that Ranger's going to have only a military icon, Steward's only going to have an intrigue icon, and Builder's only going to have a power icon, and that you have to build your deck and play the game in a way that these monocons start to synergize with each other and build around that, which I think is interesting.
Interesting, but tough, you think? Like
that's going to be tough, especially in a small card pool, if that were the case.
Yeah.
Right? You won't have a lot of choices. But I think there's something there, because I really, really like this card. I was thinking about it for Nedley reasons again. This is Jon Snow. He was recruited to the Watch and then made a steward against his will, mostly because he could read, write, and had some chance at leadership and could be groomed and so on. And yeah. And so those are intrigue skills, basically. Except he wanted to be a ranger. He wants to go out on these other things. He wants to do what these other knights want.
And he's doing it anyways.
And so he's doing it anyways. I think that's what the card says to me. It's like, yeah, sure, he's a steward, but every time you send out rangers, he wants to be there.
What's the quote, different roads sometimes lead to the same castle?
It seems like a cheap knockoff of many roads lead to Rome.
Well, George R. R.
All
Martin
roads lead to Rome or something.
At least it's not words or wind, which, proportionate to the books, should be the flavor text on about a quarter of the cards. I guess I can give us another card. I can give us Take the Black. I think this is the card you were referring to earlier, Florian?
Yeah, that so I was referring to when I said that three-cost characters aren't that good.
So this is a three-cost event that says Take the Black. It says Dominance, Choose, and then we don't know, and then it says Unique Character with printed something, presumably X or lower, because that's an X word we see, take control of that character. So this is the Night's Watch recruiting. It's a dominance action that costs 3 gold. So you gotta let 3 gold sit all the way to dominance. A max 1 per round. But so you're thinking that's gonna say choose a unique character or a non-unique character with printed cost 3 or lower? Is what you're thinking?
I thought about this and I can't remember right now.
Oh, it also does look like it's loyal.
Something was indicating to me that it must be a deterrent to play 3 or lower cost characters, but I can't remember right now.
It's probably just that it's 3 cost and you probably don't want it to generate a resource advantage as well.
It does generate a resource advantage already because you're paying 3 and they lose 3 and you gain 3.
Yeah,
so
yeah, but anything more than that might be excessive.
Yeah. Where did I see this?
Although we've never seen an event that cost 3 yet. Like that's
is that print like is it printed cost? Could be printed strength too, right?
It could be, yeah, actually. It could have to do with strength.
Yeah.
I guess that's a lot of speculation.
That is a lot of speculation.
Yeah, choose a unique or non-unique character with printed cost or strength or lower. And take
something
control of the
lower.
Dominance.
We also have the text somewhat on Sword in the Darkness. Want to give us that, Florian?
Sure. It's a one cost event for the Night's Watch. It reads something like a challenge in which you... It does something when you participate in a challenge with a Night's Watch character. At least the first paragraph looks like a play condition.
Yeah.
And then it says you win a challenge by, the next line is, as the defending player. So that's probably if you win a challenge by a certain amount of strength as the defending player.
That's probably
then you probably, that probably says choose an opponent and that opponent cannot initiate other challenges against you this round. That's my interpretation there.
So that would be a very strong defensive card, right? You overcommit to one challenge and then they can't attack you again.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. I think there was a card spoiler for the Night's Watch as well that is sort of like Frozen Outpost, which would corroborate this theme of defense as well.
And even Nate said in the article, he was saying the Night's Watch are trying to defend the wall, and it makes sense for them to have a sort of defensive tilt to them, although Jon Snow isn't very defensive at all. Maybe he's the guy that stands out.
I like the fact that these cards...
Oh, wait, sorry. Can I just interrupt for 1 second? Yes. I forgot. Castle Black stands the defending character, so my point stands.
Excellent. You had that
Florian,
pun line
who makes bad jokes. Okay.
Well, maybe we can go over things a little bit faster for these ones. So, John, want to give us a sort of broad strokes look at these, because they all seem to interact?
First, I think it's awesome that they're all the same piece of art broken up into little chunks. That's cool.
The art from the box, yeah.
Yeah. Then we got the 3 hatchlings. All of them cost 3. Drogon has a military icon, Rhaegal has an intrigue in a military, and Viserys has a military and a power. And I'm sorry, Viserys actually costs 2, not 3. Viserion says, no attachments. Each Stormborn character you control gains stealth. Stormborn. Ooh, and he's a dragon and a hatchling. Rangel's a dragon and a hatchling has no attachment. Reaction, after you win a challenge in which a Stormborn character you control is participating, choose to stand a Stormborn character. Limit once per phase. Interesting. And then Drogon is each Stormborn character you control gains renown. So you can see that they create this monstrous engine for Stormborn characters when they're all in play, if you can get them all in play. Meanwhile, we have a Stormborn character in Daenerys Targaryen, a 7-cost character who has intrigue and a power icon. She has that insight keyword again, which we have no idea what it does. And it says, while Daenerys Targaryen is standing, each character participating on an opponent's side in a challenge against you gets -1 strength. She is awesome. The dragon's power up. She gives a -1 blanket negative, and we already know from first set that that's a powerful effect. She's probably worth the 7-cost, because she's got this insight thing too, which is at least as good as Bran.
And again, I really like the Nedley aspect of this, because Dany, without her dragons, would not have been something that
that's
matters.
Great.
But here, you can give her renown, you can stand her once a turn, or once a phase, you give her stealth, she has insight, whatever the heck that is. I guess the weirdest thing about this is that all these dragons refer to a Stormborn character, and really, in the lore, there could only be one Stormborn character, Dany? Is this just so that future versions of Dany don't necessarily have to interact with the hatchlings?
I think that's a good idea, because these hatchlings are very powerful, so if they release a cheaper version or, you know, of Dany at lower cost, or one that has a really powerful effect all by itself, it could be a balancing issue. So I think it's good that they're using the Stormborn train, because then they can decide if each Dany they print from now on should gain the abilities of these hatchlings or not. Yeah.
And of all of these, it only looks like Dany is loyal, which is worth noting. Not that you would play the dragons if you didn't have Dany. Well, you might. I don't know. Their icon balance looks reasonable. But, clearly the dragons don't have to be loyal. Just Dany does.
I also realize now why exactly John was talking about her artwork being ugly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because she doesn't look like what we are conditioned to feel that Daenerys Targaryen looks like by now. She looks too old, in my opinion.
She does, yeah.
She looks like 25 or something.
Oh, older.
At least. And in the books, she has always 14 to 16. That's like the range of age that she's in the book. And that just doesn't fit her character, I think.
Yeah, there is that.
Yeah, I love the dragons, though.
Now, in this screenshot, we can see a rose road, and all that we see is that it's 0-cost, and that it's a location, and that it has the word limb, which I suspect is limited, right? That makes the most sense. Something that looks like Dothraki Sea, and we have a Khal Drogo, which has a power on him, so maybe I could guess that he has renown, that he's a Dothraki lord, and something about an additional military challenge this phase. I don't know if there's a conditional to trigger it or something. So, Florian, want to give us some event overviews then?
Sure. First event that stands out to me because it's in the front is Fire and Blood, and it's a Targaryen event that appears to be loyal, and it costs 1, and it says, challenge action. Choose a unique Targaryen character in your death pile and shuttle it back into your deck. If that character is a hatchling, you may put it into play instead. So that looks very interesting. And if Heads on Spikes turns out to be too powerful, I think a lot of players are going to resort to playing Targaryen because you can effectively negate the effect that Heads on Spikes has on you.
Seems to me to be building for a combo deck, right? Essentially making sure that you can have your hatchlings in play so that you can power up Dany.
Depends. I obviously don't know how powerful single characters are going to be in the second edition. If you only have one hatchling, how good is that? But if you play Fire and Blood right now, I mean, in the first edition, a card like this would be pretty busted, as we see on stuff like To Be a Dragon. That's pretty good. And even if you only can get...
Well, it shuffles it back into your deck, not into play. That's a pretty...
I mean, hatchlings can
be
returned to play immediately, which is pretty powerful. Getting a character mid-challenge is a pretty huge swing.
Yeah, definitely. I guess we also get to see what was I referring to it earlier? Like the Kraken's Shrimp? It turns out it's the Kraken's Grasp.
I like shrimp more.
It looks like we guessed the text fairly well. Play only if you're the first player. Challenges action. Choose a defending character with strength 5 or lower. That character does not contribute its strength to the challenge. Looks like we're getting an unopposed deck for Greyjoy.
Sounds like a Greyjoy-y thing to do.
We also have, well, a bunch of other events. But again, so I actually want to comment on the Fire and Blood artwork. At Worlds this year, Dave Stroms, you know, the best known as a Targaryen player, complained to me that he'd seen this artwork and that FFG had never used it. And he showed me the full artwork. It's amazing. It, you know, Dany, her hair is burnt off. She's gone through the pyre. She has the dragons. The pyre's in the background. It's an amazing piece of art, and I'm so happy to see it on a card here.
Also, incredibly convenient censorship of her nipple.
Not that convenient. She's looking away. Oh, I see. Oh. Ash.
That piece of ash that is lying in front of her.
I noticed that. Name of a lot of other events. Winter's Coming, Sword of the Darkness that we already saw. Scene in the Flames, Treachery. But we can still see the text on a couple others. Do you want to give us another one?
Sure. The Bear and the Maiden Fair. It seems to be a House Tyrell event for zero cost. And it has a trade, which I hope means something. I mean, FFG has been known to print trades for no avail on cards, but it is a song. And it says, action, choose a player. Look at the top 5 cards of that player's deck. Place up to 3 of those cards on the bottom of that deck and the others on top in any order. So, from my experience in LCGs in general, this tends to not be what you want to be doing with your cards because it is inherent card disadvantage.
Except if you, I mean, think back to the Much and More argument. That's inherent card disadvantage, but card quality advantage.
Yeah, but it's...
I'm just wondering whether you're going to use this to choke your opponent or to benefit yourself. I'm actually really intrigued by this card.
At least Much and More replaces itself. This doesn't even replace itself, right?
True, but if you can look at your opponent's deck and make sure they can't get attachment removal and you have a good attachment... Or you make sure they draw nothing but locations for the next turn?
Yeah. I mean, there's some value if there's not a lot of shuffle effects and if they're only still drawing 2 cards. But, you know, looking at the top 5 cards of your opponent's deck doesn't necessarily, as we've seen for Much and More, mean that you're going to have 2 bad cards in those 5.
Yeah, I think this card is pretty difficult to evaluate. As long as we don't know how decks are going to be structured, what composition of cards it's going to contain, because we don't even know how many locations or cards that are useless on their own are going to go into a deck. Maybe there's only going to be 5 locations or something in each deck, and everything else is going to be characters, and you're going to just reorder the deck.
And just give them different characters. Yeah, that's a fair point. John, want to give us one of the other 2, either Confinement or Tears of Lys?
Well, Tears of Lys has a ton of text. It's 1 cost, so 1 gold. It's an event, of course. It seems to have a keyword, looks like poison or something like that.
That would make sense.
Reaction, after you win something, the attacking player places a character without an intrigue icon by the losing opponent phase. If not, that character something token... and kill. That's what I got from that. Anyone get any better?
Yeah, that's aside from the fact, I don't know, it looks like it does something bad to a character with an intrigue icon that will eventually kill
him. No, without an intrigue icon. This says a character without
an intrigue icon.
Something bad to characters without intrigue icons.
But it looks like there's probably a bunch of conditionals, so I don't think we can say much about the card.
Under 8 different conditions, yeah. I don't know.
And something token. Power token, gold token, I don't know.
Maybe it's a character that has a power token on them. It can kill them if you...
If they don't have an intrigue icon
and you win the challenge by something.
here's one that might help your case, Florian. This is Confinement, a 1-cost Martell event. First Martell event we've seen. It says something character probably with strength 4. Until the end of the phase, that probably loses all 3 icons, or at least an intrigue and a power icon. So that looks like it's a strength 4 threshold for what it can target. But if I think it would make sense for, especially given that we've seen Kraken's Grasp affecting strength something or lower, and this one's strength something or lower, I think that's an indirect way to empower strong characters, to make sure that you can justify spending 6 or 7 gold on a character because they can't be soft controlled.
That'd make a lot of sense. I mean, we haven't actually seen any plots with really high gold value, so these large characters might be pretty big investments in this game. And, you know, giving them some out versus the soft control or even the hard control effects might be a way to make the investment worth it.
The next two we can do together, I suppose. So want to pick a card for you out of the ones?
Yeah, I complained about the new Fear of Winter already. So I'm just going to go with the Winds of Winter, which is a plot that does absolutely squat and has as stats 3 gold, 4 initiative, and 2 claim and a reserve value of 5. Well, yeah, I don't know. This artwork is just so... It's such a great artwork, and I hate to see it on a plot that is likely going to be outclassed.
It's interesting, the reserve is 5, so that probably is a good indication that the heads on pikes we saw earlier has a decent reserve value. Again, we see a trait, the winter trait. I'm hoping that these traits have value. If not, FFG, why are you putting traits on things? But it's pretty generic. But I'd like to follow.
It's generic, but it's claim 2,
true.
And you can run 2
of
them.
It could just be the generic claim 2 plot we need for the core set, right? Like, we have March to the Wall. There's another plot that's revealed in these screenshots. It's 4-8-1. That's really a good stat line normally in 1.0. It says 1 revealed. It also has 5 reserve, which is the same as... A Winds of Winter, which is making me think even more that that's the average. 1 revealed, each player chooses a character he or she controls, a fable, and discards it from play, cannot be saved.
I think we've seen that text before.
Seems about the same.
Well, it's more gold, more
initiative. But I mean, the effect is the same. It has the Edict trait. So again, that's a weird trait to give March to the Wall.
No. It kind of makes sense. That by decree, someone is sent off to the wall.
It wouldn't jump to my mind unless there was something to do with these traits.
And then I guess I'll cover the last card that we get to see for the first time on these, which is Ghost. We've seen this artwork before. He's a 4 gold, 3 strength military monocon with the direwolf trait. He is not loyal. No attachments and stealth. And basically a text that confirms that stealth works the way we thought it did. Reaction, after Ghost bypasses a character using stealth, that character cannot be declared as a defender for any challenges until the end of the phase. So this doesn't seem to be a very defensive card, but it seems to work reasonably well with Jon Snow, for instance, in that it'll help you get multiple aggressive challenges. So maybe Jon and Ghost and Ice is the closing module in the deck, and the rest is all defensive. I don't know.
But what it does... support is the theory that Knights was just going to have characters with only monocons. Because
the card next to it is also a monocon.
Exactly that.
And an intrigue monocon, but we can't.
I mean, 3 cards are not large enough a sample size to really say for sure, but I think there's an indication here.
But we haven't seen anything that doesn't, right? We haven't seen anything with more than one icon in Night's Watch, which is weird. Alright, so the plots. Who are we on?
Yeah.
Florian, want to give us a plot?
I'm going to do a Game of Thrones. It's a plot with 4 gold, 2 initiative, and 1 claim. It's a scheme, and it says a player cannot initiate a military or a power challenge unless he or she has won an intrigue challenge that phase, and it has a plot deck limit of 1 and 6 reserve. So this is basically... Shadows and Spiders, I think it's called.
But instead of a 3-0-1, we have...
And I think it makes sense that it has the plot deck limit of 1, because you could... If you have a reliable way to win intrigue challenges, you could just lock your opponent out of the game for 2 turns.
Yeah, it's a very stall plot, very much so. It keeps the game stagnant, so it makes sense to limit that.
We've already seen Heads and Spikes, so I'll do a Storm of Swords. It has the war trait. It's a plot. We have no idea what its stats are. And I'm guessing, other than the 5 reserve, and I'm guessing unless you initiate it, it says military challenge during the challenge phase. So I'm guessing that, like the current Storm of Swords, you get to initiate another military challenge during the challenge phase.
And a reserve value of 5. So we're seeing quite a few 5s and 6s. And we're seeing quite a few 3s and 4s for gold, right? Or basically all 4s?
Yeah.
so far. Because we can also see the gold on what is almost certainly Wildfire Assault because of
and
the way
the
it looks. It looks like it's a 4-7-1.
Well, Winds of Winter has 3 gold.
That's right. So that's probably one of the biggest things to come out of this is people are wondering how on earth do you play a 7 gold character? And we haven't seen the stats on any of the income locations and stuff, so we don't know whether it's just that plot gold is less meaningful or whether we've only seen plots with low gold and flashy effects because they look cooler and they don't want to show us a 700 because nobody gives. I mean, that might just be it. Who knows? We can see the name Counting Coppers, which looks like it has a kingdom trait, but aside from that, it looks like it is either 8 or 3 initiative and 1 claim.
Well, that's I mean, it. Counting Coppers was in that the in one of the draft packs, right?
Yeah, I think it's originally a CCG card, but I don't know if the text will be anything like that. To me, Counting Coppers suggests gold, not cards, but in the CCG and in the draft.
It'll allow you to skip the taxation phase, however useful that is going to be.
Well, if you skip the reserve check, that might actually be meaningful, right? So you may have just opened up design space for us.
Maybe FFG should hire me.
So there are a couple other, you know, vague... long shots,
tables,
cards, and tables. Cards that I'm not entirely sure whether we can say anything about them. I'm looking at the other list of cards. It looks like there's a version of Old Bear Mormont with 2 icons, actually. I only say that because we've seen the art in a higher res form rather than this tiny form before. It looks like there's some Vera lady with an intrigue and a power icon. It looks like there's some barrel guy with a military and power icon. That doesn't tell us much. What else are we missing? People are convinced they can see the Red Viper with 3 power on him. And, in this blurry, blurry shot of Martell cards, I don't think we can get much information from that either.
Yeah.
I guess overall thoughts, not only does the promotional video look pretty cool and do things really neatly, it also, I was under the impression that the whole point of having the text the name for an attachment at the bottom was that you would slide it so that you could read the name, which they don't do at all. And then they have the screw up with the long claw on Eddard, which we already know doesn't work. So this is in keeping with FFG's promotional material. Typically has at least one mistake in it.
It's like the people doing it don't know the game. What is it? It's too bad.
It's too bad. Well, I don't think those things matter, right? The players who are paying that much attention know it's a mistake, and the other ones aren't going to be like, oh, but I really wanted to put Longclaw on Eddard, now I'm not going to buy the game. You know, I don't think that's the deciding point. Sorry, there was one other picture that people have commented on, which is this long-distance blurry shot of what really looks like the 2 claim city plot.
The one that copies another city, right?
Yeah, and I don't know why they'd reuse that art, because I've never liked it. And I don't know, it seems to be for a Martell card, and I kind of hope cities aren't coming back yet, but who knows?
I mean, cities are amazing. They make plot building so much more interesting. And can you imagine cities when you get to run, like, 2 a city besieged? That would be amazing.
Oh my god.
That sounds so
I'm going to kneel all your guys. I'm going to kneel all your guys. I'm going to copy kneeling all your guys.
Yeah, get a copy it one more time.
That sounds horrendous. So, I mean, what are your thoughts coming out of this? Gold curve wise, strength curve wise, icon distribution.
I'm a little
that you know, gold on events. Anything that really jumps out
to you? What really jumps out to me is that there's not gonna be Lannister. It's dead.
There is a shot.
Well,
of
but
Lannister
we don't
again,
have any close-up shots from Lannister cards. Just I don't know. Maybe they want to sucker punch Lannister players a little bit.
So they don't. It's like turns out all your cards are well. This is Nate French. His favorite faction is Lannister. I don't think we're going to see Lannister get shafted. Yeah, I mean, how do you guys think we're going to be able to play high gold characters? How do you think that's going to play out?
I was going to say I don't know. I'm assuming that either the economy locations are going to be plentiful, or they're going to give you more than 1 goal. Or, like you said, Alex, there's a bunch of plots we haven't seen, and maybe that Counting Coppers is a friggin' 10 gold plot, who knows, right? Like, I doubt it with the other stats, but there might be a downside to it, you know? If you're taking a loan from the Iron Bank and something bad's going to happen.
I've heard a lot of people say that maybe taxation isn't all your gold, but I don't think that really solves the problem, because if you're only generating 5, Can you justify ever saving some over to spend 7 on the next character? I mean, these 7 golds look good, but...
I just realized, just completely off topic, that second edition is going to have a plot that doesn't have an effect, which I think is completely new when you look at the first edition. I don't think there's a plot in the first edition that has no rules text. Even the ones that have 2 claim but are only applicable in melee or something.
I can't think of any, no. I mean, we tend to mock things like Song of Summer as basically being blank, but they're not. So you're right, I can't think of a no-text plot at all. But if the place to introduce one of those is in the core set.
Yeah.
So I guess that makes sense to me, to give you a baseline for Claim 2 plots, especially if you have to be careful with them. If you think they're going to be quite dangerous, you start there, and then you see how people play with Claim 2.
I mean, one thing that expensive characters do is they make high claim military challenges much more potent. If you spend 1 turn to play this big character instead of a lot of small characters, it makes you a lot more vulnerable to losing all your good characters to a high claim military challenge, which I think is cool because over the time, the value of claim has sort of deteriorated in the first edition. And I like to see this effect reversed, but that comes with the caveat that now the designers have to be more careful with these plots again, which would just support the theory why there is no additional text on that plot.
So before we close off, we've seen all these cards, we've talked about them. We have been given by FFG, for the first time ever, a 2.0 spoiler to go alongside the article that came out earlier today. And this is the reason that we had to delay our episode. We really wanted to do this, at least this first time, release it the same day as we could, and we could only release this after the article had aired on the FFG site. So we still have not seen the plot article, but we knew it was happening because we were sent a plot to go along with it. So we're going to speculate about the article from this plot. Care to read it out to us, Florian?
Sure. It is a plot, as Alex already said, naval superiority. It has 2 gold on it, 7 initiative, 1 claim, and it has the traits siege and war. And it says, treat the base gold value on each revealed kingdom and each revealed edict plot card as if it were 0. Plot deck limit 1, reserve value 6.
Ooh.
Well, John, you were talking about some traits.
That's cool. I mean, the reserve value 6, from what we've seen, that's a little bit higher than the average. 2 gold sounds harsh, but I guess if there's a lot of edicts and a lot of... What was the other trait for him?
Kingdom.
Kingdom, then especially if they're, you know, common openers for some reason, then this could be the new blockade with a little bit of gold for you.
Yeah, it basically looks like blockade with a twist. I want to say we've seen edict plots already. So we saw Heads on Spikes, which was gold 4, and we saw March to the Wall, which was gold 4 as an edict plot. I think that's it for the edicts we've seen.
Yeah.
And the only kingdom plot we saw was the one that we thought might be high gold, which is Counting Coppers, and that was a kingdom plot. So is this sort of the... Is kingdom going to be the trait that we can expect on high gold plots, and this is the counter to them to start choke? And it's going to miss against schemes and war and siege plots? And does that make it really hard to play, or because it has 2 gold instead
cool
of 0,
does
that make it easier?
It sounds like there's a plot game now based on trait. You know, if they're running this, when do I play my plot, and you have to time it right to get value from it. So I don't know. I like that, actually.
I really like the design idea behind this, because you always want to involve both players, both sides of the table, in your game. In each mechanic, you want each side to make a decision. And a lot of plots that have very good stats, for example, in the first edition, have drawbacks that only affect you, that you can play around, that you have to plan around. This opens up a new whole thing. This is like having a plot that is an ally by extension. And that involves both players
because
in the game. Because now your opponent has to see, when would you reveal a kingdom plot? When would you reveal an edict plot? And it makes the whole experience much more dynamic, which I like very much.
I would say yes to basically everything you said with a caveat. It only works if kingdom and edict plots share something in common to the trait. not that Kingdom and Edict plots have to be the same, but that Kingdom plots have to fill a certain niche. So you can say he's going to play a Kingdom plot because he's going to play a plot that does this kind of thing. If the trait Kingdom is arbitrary on plots, then you're just guessing whether he happened to have a specific. But if, for instance, all Edict plots are around 4 gold and affect the board, because we've seen March to the Wall and things like that, and we go, okay, he's probably going to use one of those, I could use Naval Superiority, then I think it helps. Because otherwise I think it's a little too much complexity for a beginner to know every single plot and to know which one is going to be flipped. But if you can categorize them and know that Edict plots tend to do this kind of thing and Kingdom plots tend to do this kind of thing.
I don't think they necessarily have to do the same thing. Edict plots only have to share a certain power level that is higher than the standard. Because what happens if you are able to construct an entire plot deck that consists of Edict plot cards that is very powerful for that reason, but then has the drawback that someone with Naval Superiority is just going to own your day? That's another consideration there. I think it isn't necessarily the limit to the type of effects that are printed on those plots, but also the power level of those plots.
Yeah, I think you're right, Floyd. I think that, like you were saying, it doesn't have to be the same effect, but if all of them are more powerful, then you slip something like this in to kind of counteract that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really like the idea of allies being more powerful because they're more vulnerable in that specific way. I mean, to some extent, yes. But to me, I would like this more to work, and I know this is to a game I don't even play, but I've heard talk about. In Netrunner, you know that your opponent's barriers will tend to have a certain set of categories, even if you don't know every specific barrier in the game. You'll know that that kind of ice will tend to have things that will end your run. Well, you'll know that sentries will tend to have ways to attack you, and so on. And I hope that that's what this is. I hope that its Kingdom plots will tend to be, I don't know, high gold, while Edict plots will tend to manipulate the board. And so that you'll say, okay, what I really don't want him to flip a high gold plot next turn. I want to choke him out. I'll use Naval Superiority. And I think that's the kind of categorization that would make this interesting. But again, the artwork looks really good. And hopefully, by the time listeners have listened to this and seen this spoiler, they've already seen all the stuff in the plot article, and we can be proven completely wrong. And that would be wonderful. Or right, and that would be unlikely.
So for some closing comments, we have a ton of regionals coming up. I think the 23rd of May is chock full. We have one in Gatineau here.
Hold on, that's 2 weeks from now. We got a bunch of stuff this next week.
We got one in D.C. We got one in Louisville. All on the 23rd.
Yeah. Nah, we're jumping ahead of ourselves. The one in Louisville is worth mentioning, though, because that was initially posted on a different day and has been moved to the 23rd. That's updated on FFG's site. All of that is cleared up. But if you had looked at it earlier and you were thinking about the Louisville, Kentucky regional, that has actually been moved to the 23rd of May. So that's
Gatineau's worth mentioning because it's in our area, right?
But next week still has a bunch of regionals. There's a regional in Poland. There's a regional in – well, there's Milano Ghost Italic in Italy. There's a regional in Murcia in Spain. There's one in Toulouse in France. There's one in Budapest in Hungary, and there's one in Las Vegas in Nevada.
Ooh.
So, I mean, this from now on, I think it's all big weekends for regionals. We had two or three over the last 2 weeks, and I think things are basically in full swing now. Yeah, the weekend of the 23rd, 24th has, I think, 10 regionals coming up next week, for the week after that.
I probably think the Go to Shalik event will be the largest of the events this coming weekend, so it'll be interesting to hopefully see some streams from that.
Yeah, I haven't heard specifically about it, but I would really like to see some streams. Early on in regional season, one of the biggest events, and therefore can be somewhat defining for some of the decks that we see.
Mm-hmm. Shape the meta, for sure.
Now, aside from that, I want to thank listeners for bearing with us and allowing us to air this a little bit later so that we could get the spoiler to you. We won't be doing this kind of thing, even if we do get future spoilers, because we don't want to continuously delay our episodes or we'd be, you know, posting them on Tuesdays. But, you know, this is fun. This was a first.
Yep.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall. If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.
Likely sooner than later during hello, life of the game.
We're joined by a force reviewer.
Can't talk yet, though, because you just turned one. And now that you've talked to her, Florian, she's going to talk.
I cannot open it.
Well, care to try harder?
I'm trying hard by
left-clicking
on the image. Oh, now it just opened, 25 files at once.